Hello and welcome to the majestic Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 21st, 2003. Today's session is The Common Good versus Self-Centered Individualism. Session 1 of Politics and Public Policy, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
The common good against self-interested individualism. And I'm John Marty. I'm a state senator from Minnesota, and talking about a variety of public policy related issues this week. And this is what I wanted to get into because of the fact that I think we've lost something we've had in the past, and that is a sense of a social good, a common good in the country, which might be defined as the sense we're more than a collection of individuals. We're, I guess the country's 300 million people almost now. We're more than 300 million individuals all out to look out for ourselves, but we are a community, a national community at the state level. We're state communities. Holden Village is a perfect place to talk about community and common good. But it's part of that recognition is not only is it better for all of us if we care about each other, if we're concerned about each other, but we also can do some things as a community we can't do on our own. Obviously, even libertarians who seem to be more opposed to any kind of government role in the common good, we recognize there are some things, in most cases, that should be done as a community. Building roads, defense, public safety issues, police and fire, things like that. But I think that there's generally been a sense in the past, and I go back to 1961, John F. Kennedy's inaugural address about, I always said it backwards, so I'll read it. Ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. Very much a non-what's in it for me sort of thing, but the whole concept, the Peace Corps and other initiatives being started in the early 1960s, were the sense that we owe something to our country, we owe something to our community, and it's a common good sort of thing. Now I'd argue it's become much more, I got mine or I want mine, and anything else is taking away from my whatever is bad. And at least in terms of the political sphere, I don't know that the community, that the public at large feels that way, but the political appeals in recent years have been very much that. And I would describe, in finishing the description of common good, I'd say it's the opposite of self-interested individualism, where the goal under that may be to maximize one's personal interests, one's personal finances, one's personal freedom, one's ability to get more for themselves, regardless of the expense of others. And while I think there is a change, there's been a shift in recent decades, that we are not, that the political appeals you hear are more about self-interested things, I'm not sure that the public at large necessarily believes it. To a certain point, we all do. We're all looking out for ourselves. We have to look out for ourselves. Who's going to look out for you if you don't? But most people have a sense that the survival of the fittest dog-eat-dog world isn't all there is, and that in addition to us personally being healthy and well-educated and financially stable, there is some good reason for our sake and for the common sake that we want our neighbors to be well-educated and healthy and financially stable as well. It reflects the fact people would rather live in a neighborhood where people are well-educated and healthy than in one where they're not. We're reflected in our sense of civic obligation. If we required everything was enforced by law enforcement, we couldn't have society the way we do. Taxes is basically voluntary. Most of us could cheat on our taxes and nobody'd know. And frankly, a lot of people do cheat, but bottom line is very few people are audited. And most people don't cheat. They may fudge a little bit here or there, but for the most part, there's taxes are a voluntarily enforced type of thing. When you see traffic lanes cutting down from 2 to 1, you don't see everybody. You see a few cars who violate it, but most cars try and merge instead of wait to the last minute and save all the time and cut around people. There's a sense of security. And I know when you're in a hurry, you kind of, oops, maybe we got to get there, we can save all this time. But there is a public value that we are trying, that we are part of a broader community, and we care about that community. And that community has certain values and principles that we uphold. And part of this consensus, a lot of our economic consensus about concern for those less fortunate, came part of our government in the 1930s in the New Deal. The commitment that those who work a certain amount of time, 40 hours was the final determination of what full time was. They were going to earn a minimum wage. It wasn't going to make them wealthy, but it was going to be enough that they'd have a roof over their head, they'd have enough food for their kids, some basic necessities. In the 1960s, the civic consensus expanded to face some new challenges related to the environment. Since that we are, it's our planet, we have to take care of our planet, we care about our planet. And there are plenty of other parts of this common consensus. Education. I heard there's often you get to the point where people are, well, they want good education for their kids, but I heard one school board member in a small Minnesota community say, she doesn't just want good education for the kids in her district. If she ever needs brain surgery, frankly, the brain surgeon and the nurses and everybody else in the hospital probably aren't going to have been raised in her school district. She hopes they got a good education wherever they came from. But the consensus that we want all kids to get a good education, that seniors should have a secure retirement, I mean, that grew out of the New Deal. Families would have decent housing, the poor wouldn't go hungry. And this was never, this consensus about common good was never unanimous. There have always been people, there always will be, no matter what the consensus is in politics or in society, there are always going to be people who disagree with that. And furthermore, even among those of us who may have believed in the consensus about a common good, it was often limited to people who are like us. Well, until 1970s, 80s, maybe even now, people of a different race. Well, I don't want them getting it, or the single parent, or the unemployed. Somehow or another, we didn't always extend the common good in that we're caring about them to everybody. But generally, there was this sense of common good. Enough so that after World War II, we invested billions of dollars. I think in today's dollars, they say it would be like close to $100 billion in the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe. What did we have in that? Well, we cared. We wanted to help the countries that were beat up. We helped even Germany. We helped even our opponents in the war. We gave much to them. Now, in contrast today, we couldn't possibly get a Marshall Plan to rebuild some of the problems we have in our own country. There's not that consensus anymore, at least in the political system. And it's not that we don't have the money in society. Yeah. You know, when you read these news stories about, I don't know if it was the guy from Enron with the $6,000 shower curtain, and we have the extreme wealth stories, kids in their 20s, 30s, and 40s who are becoming billionaires through internet and high-tech things several years ago, and yeah, they lost all they had, or at least 80% of it, meaning they still only have tens or hundreds of millions. But you look at Lexus dealers and yacht sales and everything else, the last couple years have been a downturn, but still, there's a lot of money in the economy. We're the richest our country's ever been, and our country is the richest in the world per capita, and we're doing very well. But nevertheless, there is no sense that politically anybody could push for a Marshall Plan, even for our own neighbors. And this, I got mine, I earned it attitude is, I think, spreading in a sense, at least in the political sense. I had written something after a recent legislative session back in Minnesota about something about the concept of living wage jobs and how people deserve a chance to catch up and how so many people are getting marginalized. Some woman, a single parent, was saying how she's been struggling to put her kids through school, she's been struggling to get a college degree herself while supporting her kids, and how hard it is, and how these programs are being cut that helped her. And she says, and the thing that gets me is all these immigrants coming in, and they're taking all our, and they're getting all this money, and they're getting all this. Here she was saying, you know, she recognized how she had this need herself, but don't give it to anybody else. It's a sense that somebody's getting a fair shake and I'm not. And this is not only an economic issue. Compassion or the way we treat others in terms of what names we call others has been changed. What used to be in the 1950s, 60s, you wouldn't call what we might now call an African-American or black person, you would not have called them a nigger. It was an insult. Everybody knew it. Some people would use the terminology, but they were trying to be offensive. And polite society did not accept that. Now you get the term political correctness. If somebody talks about a person with disabilities instead of a crippled person or something else, because they'd rather be called that. Well, it's just a bunch of political correctness. In effect, somebody who is trying to say something sensitive to somebody else is now being thrown an insult. You are being politically correct. Names about those who, politicians who are concerned about the poor and others are wasteful, big spending liberals. We reframe the debate so that things that we might have once seen as pushing towards a common good are becoming seen as negatives or insults. And when you look at this, there is still political talk about the common good. There's still a talk that we care about our environment or whatever else. But even among the political leaders who talk about the common good, it's always tinged with, because it's good for you, because you're going to benefit from doing this. It's never in the 1960s, I think in Minnesota, we had Hubert Humphrey who would talk about, by golly, we Minnesotans are good people, and we care about our senior citizens, and we're going to make sure they have a decent healthcare system, and we're going to make sure they have good nursing homes to be in. Nowadays, politicians would say, yeah, we care about seniors, and we want to have good nursing homes because you deserve it. And it's an appeal to somebody who, the appeal is meant, aimed at seniors, people who are more likely to have friends and family in a nursing home. It's tinged even there with the self-interest. When we talk about we want excellent opportunities for education because our kids deserve that, it's always because our kids deserve that. And like that woman who contacted me saying, yeah, don't take the support out from me trying to get a higher education while I'm trying to support a family, but those other people. The same thing with the quality education. I see colleagues from rural Minnesota talking about, yeah, we want more money for education in our schools. Take it away from those rich suburban schools, or take it away from those inner city schools where the kids are failing anyway and they don't care. Or in the suburban schools. Take it away from those rural communities where there's so few kids anyhow, they should be closing schools and consolidating so it's more efficient. Even there, again, the common good is tinged with because it's good for you, and the people I'm speaking to are the ones I'm going to make sure they see why it's in their interest. And again, many cases, most cases, I'd argue, politicians don't even talk about the common good. They talk about how you can get more for what you have. Who can make, I think this started in about the early 80s and the Reagan years, to talk about who can better spend your money, you or that evil big government. Jesse Ventura, our last and more colorful governor, made a comment in his policies I thought were better than he was in some ways, and though you never knew where he was coming from on some things. At one point he said he was going to raise taxes. He tried to raise taxes, and then other times when it fell through, he said, he never raised taxes once in his 4 years in office. But one of the comments that he made that summarized very well the sense of how we build this anti-common good consensus in politics, he talked about a guy I think he referred to as a ditch digger, Joe Average Working Person. Joe Ditch Digger, who makes $100 and the government comes and takes $40 away from it and gives it to others. And the implication was that that these others are lazy bums who won't work and won't support themselves, and they're taking away 40% of his money and giving it to somebody else. And this is, Ventura said that, and at times he may have felt that way. This is a very common theme among certain right-wing radio show hosts, Rush Limbaugh types, who are very much into this government is taking your money and giving it away to somebody lesser than you. less qualified, less valuable, less deserving of it. And I figure you take a look at that, the reality check on what Ventura or some of those right-wing hosts would say. If government's taking $40 out of $100 in your paycheck, what do they use it for? Well, they use it for roads, which not only the ditch digger would drive to on the way to work, and on the way to the grocery store, on the way home, but frankly, maybe the one who's contracting with the ditch digger's company to give him the job because he needed ditches for whatever the road. Schools where he received an education, where his kids may be receiving an education. Schools in Minnesota, education is 40% of our state budget. Police and fire. Frankly, the ditch digger, like me and like you and like every one of us, benefits from public safety efforts. National defense. I think we all understand the importance of national defense, environmental protection, public health, infectious diseases. I mean, after 9/11, everybody is concerned about anthrax and smallpox, and I think we're glad that some money is spent on those issues. Parks and recreation, we take the family on vacation where the kids play in the afternoon. Food and Drug Administration, Federal Aviation Administration. Frankly, if the way manufacturers of autos were before government started regulating safety, if airplanes didn't have the FAA to regulate them, I think we have more fatalities in airlines, and I don't think most of us would consider that a good trade-off. But is that money being taken from you and given to somebody else? Because that's part of that $40. Other regulatory agencies are designed to protect us as individual consumers or us as a society from predatory and unscrupulous business practices. All of this, all of those examples are things that the ditch digger, frankly, benefits from, and that's the vast majority of what government's using it for. But nevertheless, the talk radio concept is this money is taken from you, given to others, that's bad. Christian concept of compassion for others is nothing to do with politics. And of course, even the part that does go to those others, the welfare types of things, the health and human services programs, you know, frankly, the ditch digger's parents may be moving into a nursing home sometime, and they may benefit from it. Ditch digger's niece may be learning disabled and need special education programs at the school. Ditch digger himself may sometime become disabled, not able to pay medical bills. And so those others are very often us. But you think how many people are one paycheck, two paychecks away from being homeless? Unemployment or divorce or whatever else, so many times those others become us. Anyhow, that's, I want to, before opening up for discussion, would like to propose several ideas on why this trend is occurring, because I think it's a very definite trend. And the first argument I make is the one of people in my profession. There are very few, perhaps no major political voices or forces speaking out for a sense of common good, at least in terms of the common good and helping those less fortunate. There are plenty of groups who do speak out about the common good, about the environment, or certain other areas of what we might call common good or consensus or public good. But speaking out for those less fortunate, there's not a lot of talk about that. In Minnesota, whenever there were big tax cuts 4 or 5 years ago, all three major political parties in Minnesota at the time were saying this is heavily tilted towards the middle class. Well, middle class, it was actually heavily tilted towards higher income folks, but you know, almost everybody thinks they're middle class, probably all but the top 0.5% at the top and the top bottom 2% at the bottom. Everybody sees themselves as middle class, which may be good for a common consensus, but nevertheless, we're told, oh, don't ever say you're going to do something for the poor. Speak about helping seniors who are struggling or working families who whatever. You can't make an appeal to helping the poor because that's political poison. So politicians don't raise the issue if there's nobody leading, who's there to follow. There's this human sense of greed. It's in all of us. I mean, I think we all have generous instincts. We all have selfish instincts. And you can appeal to either of them. I think in past years, JFK's inaugural address, this sense of serving others. That's true of all of us. I mean, we come to Holden, we volunteer, we help out to churches and other places. Why? Because we care. And people appeal to that. That's the way every nonprofit has to appeal to raise money. They appeal to your sense of generosity. And you can appeal to that very successfully, but you can also appeal to the greed and selfishness, the self-interest in each of us of doing so. And I think when I mentioned earlier how Hubert Humphrey in the 1960s would be talking about, we care about seniors in nursing homes because it's the right thing to do. Now the thing would be, we care about seniors in nursing homes because your relatives, you might end up there. We want to make sure you have a fair shake. Well, you can appeal to generosity in people, and it did work, and I think it still does work, but very much we all have the self-interest notion in us, and the appeals are not neutral. They're not some appeals to generosity, some towards self-centeredness. At least on economic issues, I'd argue that political appeals are very much to the selfish interest. The third point I think I propose is one of the causes of this is a lack of a corporate conscience. There's some organizations around the country now trying to start talking about how our corporate laws are written. Because if you serve on a corporate board of directors, you have a fiduciary responsibility to look out for the financial interest of your shareholders. That is, you're bound to do that. You can be sued if you don't do that. And if 2% improvement in profits comes from laying off 10,000 people who you could otherwise keep on, or you can make more money by doing more harm to the environment. Clearly, you actually have, under our corporate laws, an obligation to look out for the shareholder interest rather than the consumer, the customer, your employees, the community, the environment, the other things. And there's a movement to try and change corporate laws so not only do you not get punished for doing those things, but actually that would be treated equally with shareholder interest in terms of corporate responsibility. And in the same sense that I suggest our corporate laws are set up to push and give incentives to corporations to move away from the common good, there also is likewise an incentive which shows there is a common good sense in the public for corporations to appear like they're working for the common good, which is why you get Exxon, after the Exxon Valdez incident, to run all kinds of ads talking about how sensitive and how concerned they are about our environment. Or Walmart, who may have inadequate wages and practices that pay their employees very little and no benefits and or very inadequate benefits, they run ads talking about how family and community and employee friendly they are. Why? Because we like companies that do that. I mean, they run, Walmart has all these red, white, and blue ads, and very patriotic, good for America, small town America kind of business. But their business practices, I think some of you may have read the Barbara Ehrenreich book, Nickel and Dime, Getting By. Yeah, it's an excellent book. Anyhow, she took jobs in several low-wage places, Walmart was one of them, and just talking about the challenges and the struggles for somebody to live there. So in the same way that the corporate incentive is the anti-common good, the incentive is to appear like they are common good. So you have anti-environmentalists trying to look like they're environmental. But bottom line is the corporate conscience is not there, and it actually works against the common good. Fairness doctrine is gone. We used to have, politically at least, we have equal time for political views. If one side gets, one party or one point of view gets an airtime on broadcast media because they're public airwaves, the other side had that too. Well, now I see, you know, there's no response to Rush Limbaugh, there's no debate. It's kind of people of certain points of view that sell well. Hyping it, and there's no chance for rebuttal. Minnesota's current and former governor both had a chance to have free airtime on the largest radio station in the state once a week, an hour of airtime, no real rebuttal. There's various points of view get shut out of the debate, and and those who may be anti-government, which does sell well with a certain audience, they have a voice and others sometimes don't. Special interest money. The political system is driven, and I'm giving a talk on this later in the week, is driven by big money. People who have money get favors. It's not corrupt in the sense that you need the kind of person who will slip an envelope of cash under the table and they'll give you a favor. It's more they're human beings, and you give somebody something and they feel obligated to you, they're going to be subconsciously indebted to you and more helpful to that. Well, lots of the people who are contributing and funding the political process now are seeking things that may not be seen as common good. They're seeking weaker regulation for consumer protection, weaker environmental laws, and so that special interest money helps drive it too. Then one more, and then I'll quickly open it up for discussion. I'd argue the economy is built on consumption. Advertising is clearly geared to selling more to us. And it, in the process, not only creates a demand for us to want things that we would have considered luxuries 10 years ago, or extreme luxuries or unthinkable 20 years ago, we want those things now. And as part of the advertising, you deserve it. You are good, you deserve this, you have a hard life, everybody else gets all this stuff, you deserve these luxuries, whatever. And that helps feed our sense that we're somehow shortchanged, and we deserve all these things. And my sense is that that's one of the driving factors behind the shift. And before opening it up, I think there are ways to restore the common good. The church, religious community has an obligation. I mean, scripture talks heavily about the sense of being our brother's keeper, about being concerned about others in need, about being stewards of the environment, stewards of the planet, not people who own what we own, but they're ours for a short period of time, and we're caretakers. Community leaders, business, education, arts. Sometimes arts people will be pushing for, we need funding for the arts and so on, but some of the same people, we can't take money from something else to fund the arts. I remember when I was first elected, the University of Minnesota president was meeting with new legislators and talking with us about how urgent the needs of the university were, what can we do to help? And that was at a time of budget shortfalls in the state, and there, frankly, the university was going to get cut unless there was new money coming in, new taxes coming in. And I said, you know, to the university president that he and the Board of Regents and the top administration folks, at the same time they're getting a $25 million gift for a new school of business from a successful businessman, that maybe they have an obligation too to talk about the fact that, you know, the money that comes to fund the University of Minnesota from the state doesn't come out of thin air. It comes from tax money, and the same people who may be making generous donations to certain schools at the university may also be undercutting their state funding by saying, hey, no taxes approach. But leaders in the community have an obligation to talk about the need to be community. Politicians need to lead, I mentioned that earlier. The media, our public service obligations, and once, because we gave them free of charge, we gave them the public airwaves. They buy and sell them among themselves, but they never paid the public something. So they had obligations. Used to be they had to run public affairs broadcasts. A couple years ago, I got a call from a radio station in Alexandria, Minnesota, a moderate-sized town in rural Minnesota, and they wanted to do an interview on some issue I had been working on, and they have a half-hour public affairs program, and they wanted to know if I could they tape it ahead of time, and I asked out of curiosity, when's this going to run? Sunday, April 23rd, it's 5:30 a.m. That happened to be Easter Sunday. And I thought, Easter Sunday, 5:30 a.m. I'm sure there are a lot of people listening to whatever kind of radio station this was. I'm sure there'd be a few farmers there who happened to be listening while milking the cows. But bottom line, there may have been, it wasn't the kind of station farmers would listen to, but I figured they might have two people in the audience, you know. Why do they have that? Well, we're required under FCC law to have a half hour public affairs program. And what do they want to do? You can't sell ads during it because nobody wants to sponsor that program. It's boring. And so you put it on at 5:30 Sunday morning. But media has some obligation, and the public needs to speak out, confront the message of greed, promote the public interest. If we care about it, we should speak out about it. And finally, I would argue, when I mentioned earlier, the corporate law structure, I think we have to look at that. But I think this is the kind of topic that I hope this stimulates some discussion, whether you agree with some of the points I made or disagree with them. I guess I'd like to start out by asking if there's a sense of everybody here, is there a move away from the common good? Is it just something I'm seeing and thinking this is bizarre, or do others see what I'm seeing and hear what I'm hearing? And if so, stories about it or whatever. Go ahead.
Well, I definitely agree with you. The thing that occurs to me, my position is that it seems like immediate gratification as opposed to sort of delayed good is a prominent theme. I sit on the board of a nursing home, and we recently decided to pay more of the percentage of the burden of the health care for the workers because it was becoming intolerable for them. And in order to do that, we had to kind of gulp and say, okay, this is going to cost us a lot of money, but we think down the road it will be for the good of everybody, including the bottom line. Turns out we were right, and we were glad for that. But, you know, it sort of things, I wonder how much that immediate gratification, the sort of the belief that I better get it now when I can, because if I don't, there may not be enough left for me at the end of the meal. Deal is going on here, you know?
Mm-hmm. And it's happening, I think that's a good point about immediate gratification. It's happening at a time when we have more available and there's less risk for most of us that we're not going to have enough food at the end of the meal after everybody else has grabbed theirs. But I don't know, I wonder if that's part of the advertising, get it now kind of thing. Because yeah, you don't wait for, oh, you want to get, kids need something, or you need something, oh, wait for a birthday or Christmas, well, get it now. And
well, it's almost based on fear, you know? Like, I better make sure that I can get what I can get, because if I don't, there may not be any for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think there's a lot of fear involved in this kind of a move.
There is a fear thing there. I'm curious if that's causing instant gratification, but yeah, I think there is a, people do act a lot out of fear, and fear is not the best, I mean, it's a strong motivation, but it's not always a positive one either.
I think this movement you're talking about has been going on for 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And I sometimes have said that when I was in college in the 60s, none of us would have admitted that our goal in getting an education was to be able to get a job and make money.
Yeah.
I had one friend, I remember, who said that he wanted to be a dentist because you got paid well. And I was so embarrassed for him that he was thinking that way. And about 6 years later, I was teaching students who were coming to school knowing exactly what kind of income they were going to get because of the degree they were getting. And it had already turned some corner. And it just feels like that's gotten more and more exaggerated ever since.
I was going to say it's been about a 30-year trend. This was the 33rd anniversary of Earth Day this year, and I was working with some environmental groups on trying to get a hearing on a bill, an anti-environment bill, trying to schedule it for Earth Day just to show how we're gutting our environmental laws 30 years later. And I think the early 1970s, we still had a very strong sense of that, but shortly after that, it's been going away.
Now, I too see it as a long-term trend. There are indicators throughout the common society all the time. Frank Sinatra singing, I did it my way, and that play in the late 60s, Your Own Thing, and then titles of books, Looking Out for Number One, and the title of, there was another one that was very similar to that. We see those indicators all along the way, and I think it's a real trend that's been taking place and has not been abating. I think you're looking for a cause between this, and that's my main interest in being in here. Why is this in our culture? I think a lot of it was a turning point that took place in the late 60s, the hippies, and you know the church was being weakened badly at that point for a number of reasons. And I'm a Presbyterian. We're just having a precipitous drop in membership. I don't know how the Lutherans are doing, but I doubt if it's a strong...
Slow and steady decline.
Yeah, these are not good. And we have three foundations of values in our nation. One of them is the church, and the other one is the family, and the third is the schools. And the schools are really just silenced now, yet they can't talk about morals or values. Maybe they can in your state, but in many places they can't. That the family is under an awful lot of assault, and the church is being weakened. This does not favor the forces of good.
On that point about the biggest institutions that teach values, there's an author, a Minnesota author, named David Walks, a physician who formed a group, Institute on Media in the Family, and he makes an argument that that the biggest, that over generations, you look at what the temples we have, cathedrals in Europe, big government palaces, the schools, higher education institutions, the places that have the biggest institutions, the biggest structures, were sort of, if you use the size of the structure, somehow is a measure of influence in society. They were all things that would teach what we might call values you want to pass on to your kids. Care for others, the common good sort of sense. Now, Walsh suggests that look at what the biggest temples are, the Mall of America in Minnesota. I'm using Minnesota examples, I apologize, but I think they work for people to understand them. But the Mall of America consumption. You look at media figures, who we worship, the media figures, sports figures, consumption. And Walsh is making the argument that every one of those things teaches opposite of the values of frugality and concern for others and generosity. Values you might want to pass on to the next generation. The biggest, most powerful interests in our society now work the opposite of what it was, instead of reinforcing those values as in the past, which would have been, again, all these, I don't know if there's a 30-year-ago starting date. I think there's these two things have been clashing with each other since the beginning of time, I'm sure.
And yet you hear this term family values all the time thrown around so freely and loosely, like it's some magnet that pulls all this other stuff with it, but it doesn't mean that at all, in my opinion.
Yes, the family values are win, earn, say, you know, acquire. Those are the family values that I've been in the same town for now, it's a suburb of Dallas, for 14 years. And in the early days, when I went there, I was given football. Season tickets to the football games at the high school, and because that's football is the number one religion in Texas. I used to go. I played in the band when I was in high school, and. You know, we played, we enjoyed being in the band, we played music, we did a different show every week, and we had a lot of fun. In our school, they start in early August rehearsing one show. And each week they keep adding to it, and the whole goal is to win at the regional competition. The entertainment, the ability of music. I'll never forget one of my young students a number of years ago was playing in the band and was couldn't really play his clarinet and march at the same time. So the band director went to him and said, I need one more saxophone to make the lines perfect. If I give you a saxophone, you do not play it, but you march. You look like you're playing it, but you march so that our lines will be perfect. And I think those are the kinds of values that are being taught by those very same institutions. I could never get a verification, but I was traveling last year in another, say we had a very bad period with a very troubled superintendent of schools who most people were glad to stand at the edge of town and wave goodbye when she left. But totally unsolicited, I was in a fast food place sitting there and I was talking with a football coach from another state who asked me, he told me where I was from, and I told him, and he says, do you know so-and-so that the football, yes. And he says, well, I don't know, but this is what he told me. That there was one particular high school that was kind of the goal to win the football game. And when they finally did, the coach was called into the superintendent's office on Monday morning and given a check for $10,000. Does that tell you something about the direction of the values and what's important?
We have
tremendously safe.
Yeah, we have in Minnesota a lot of homeless people, as we do in most states, I think. And something we didn't have 25 years ago, the only homeless shelters in the Twin Cities, and Minnesota with cold winters needs places for homeless people. The only homeless shelters we had 20, 30 years ago were for chronically, mentally ill, and chemically dependent people. Now we got families, working people, living in them regularly. But we can't afford to deal with that, but boy, we sure have money. A lot of offers, they haven't succeeded yet in getting public funding for a new home for billionaire athletes. I mean, new stadiums for them, there's something that becomes a priority, and I mean, our shift of priorities there. I'm not sure if the public at large always buys that, but if there's nobody lobbying for the one, there is somebody lobbying for the other, and same with the football.
Something that was alarming to me that happened this last year, I was doing some tax reform work for Washington State, and so some business owners had gotten together and had decided to stage an anti-tax rally at the Capitol when they were making decisions about the budget. They were supposed to be voting on the budget this day, and so a bunch of church people got together and went down and ended up having about as many people down there as so there was many pro-tax as there were anti-tax people or tax reform. Somebody turned around and he was very angry because we had disrupted their whole thing, and we had lots of moms and babies with signs that said taxes for kids and stuff like that, and the media were loving us, and so it sort of thrown their whole game off, and they were really upset about that. So he turns around and he starts getting into this conversation with me and trying to talk him down, and finally he looks at me and he asks me how much I pay in taxes a year, and it's in this really sort of, like, he was just accusing me, like, well, how much do you pay in taxes a year? And I said, well, I work for a nonprofit and my salary is pretty low. And I wanted to say it's none of your business, but what came out of my mouth was probably not as much as you. And he says, exactly, that's what I'm saying. So how can you tell me how much, like, how can you make decisions about my spending if you're not paying as much as I am? And immediately I was just shocked by that because the greed was so apparent. And it wasn't that he was arguing for this would be better for society if we had taxes. It wasn't like he was even using the trickle-down theory. So, like, I didn't even, all the arguments that I had prepared weren't even valid. It was just him saying he was really greedy. And, like, how, if I didn't make as much money as he was, how could I say that he should pay more? And that was what was most alarming to me, because it's really hard to argue with, like, flat-out greed. You know,
yeah, in the past it would be, well, if we cut taxes for him, we're all going to benefit.
That wasn't his argument at all.
I was surprised to hear him say, you know, 30 years ago, he would be surprised to hear anybody at college say, I'm doing this so I can get a job and earn money. I mean, I'm 18 years old, I just graduated my senior year of high school. We had a career education class the last half of our high school where we were given a chart of careers. Mm-hmm. That, you know, told the degree you needed, how many years of college, and right next to it, it was color-coded and organized by the yearly salary.
Oh my God.
And so, I remember looking at this list, immediately, you know, of course, looking for the high 80, 90, up into the triple digits. Of course, you just throw away all the 20s and 30s, you're not interested in those. So I remember looking at this list and trying to figure out, you know, a relatively easy degree, but I could still earn a lot of money. And so, I mean, right away, you still have this list that organizes jobs by your salary. Another influence I see, especially among the younger culture, you know, I think in 12 to 18, and this general move away from the common good is, you know, in the media and the entertainment, the number one selling computer program, computer game that kids, boys and girls are playing all over the country is called The Sims, which is kind of a dollhouse simulation where the goal of the game is to make your people in your little house happy, which is done by starting a career path, and you, of course, go up in your career path and earn more money, and you buy things, and things produce happiness for your people. And you, there's challenges in the game, like your tax bill or your utilities and stuff like that. But the point is, you go up in the world, you earn more money,
you're happier,
you buy things, and the material makes you happier. And so I think, you know, it's not being taught at all. There's no semblance of a greater good being taught to. Through a public system of any sort.
Now, when you said that you had this color-coded chart handed to you, where was this? Was this at the school?
This was in a career education class. I mean, it wasn't suggested that, you know.
But then you do that, but the implication is...
Of course, you look at the chart and...
4 years of school, you can get this much, or 6 years, and you want to make this much?
Yeah. This class is required. You have to take this class.
What state is this?
This is Oregon. And they actually bring in people like pharmacists saying, look, right out of college, you make $70,000 a year. We need pharmacists. Come get money.
So values are, in a sense, being taught.
Yeah, anyway, they're very definite values.
Yeah.
Well, you can get that online too. Well,
yeah, right. I was going to say the required.
But this is required. Every single student has to take this. Has to absorb this information.
I remember thinking in that class, why would you want to be a teacher? Yeah. And our teacher, kids kept asking her, you know, so how much do you earn a year? And she's like, you know, when you can go 4 years of college and be a pharmacist and get 70,000, 75,000.
You go International Falls and get 115. Right. Yeah. That's the
sure. Yeah. But I mean, it's, you know, how do we value teachers? I mean, that's one reason why some kids are, their goal. I mean, kids have always, when I was a fourth grader, my number one career goal was to be a professional hockey player. Failing that, it was to be a professional football player. Frankly, it wasn't. I didn't quite make either one. The third one was window washer, which I'm not sure how that fit. but at that time, kids have always had this fascination with sports, and they have sports heroes, but it wasn't, hey, you can make a mitt that way. It was because you wanted to play sports, But again, I think a whole lot of, if we want to teach that we value people who work with others, teachers, we don't send that message where the teachers are required to teach a course telling us, here's how much you can make from these things. But unless
I'd like to throw out that I think that individualism versus the common good has sort of gone in cycles, at least in the U.S. in this century, like started off with the progressive era from roughly Teddy Roosevelt through Woodrow Wilson. Then World War I happened, and then it shifted to the Roaring Twenties and more individualism, and we had the tax structure was more, the burden was more on the lower classes or the working classes. And then all of a sudden everything collapsed, and we had the Great Depression, and then it shifted more back towards the common good, and that sort of carried through World War II and with the Marshall Plan, like you mentioned. And then 1950s was a little more complacency, and then the 1960s, Great Society, back to the common good, and then like the last 30 years has been more like individualism. So it seems, I mean, I get really angry, upset about the way things are going right now, and, you know, like...
But you're confident.
It feels like,
yeah,
you know, it's
a cyclical
could be
thing.
On the cusp of,
yeah.
It could like change almost overnight.
Yeah. I agree with you, there's been that sort of tradition, but I do think this time it's a little bit different, in part because of the way it's set up. Again, that David Walsh system, looking at who the main teachers of, who we look up to in society, and you look up to temples of consumerism, temples of popularity, other things like that, that are teaching values contrary to what in the past, the promotion of, public broadcasting had a special a few years ago. I saw a book in the library mentioning it here on influenza, it was called. And it was talking about how affluent. Thank you. Sorry about it. But he had talked about how consumption 100 years ago was an illness. I mean, the name for an illness that was really was an illness, a legitimate illness. And now consumption is a good thing. Frugality, terms like that, how many of us have, younger folks have grandparents who saved every plastic bottle they ever had because, you know, you reuse things, you try and find a way. I'm not convinced that this is one of those regular cycles. I hope it is. But yeah, in the late 1800s, railroad barons and oil barons just owning everything, taking over more and more. But there was a rebellion against it. But at that time, I don't know that the John D. Rockefellers and others were that popular. They were villains in many people's eyes, and not universally, but there was a sense that government had to step in and correct that. Now, who do we look up to? We look up to the billionaires, and again, not universally, but it's people who, I mean, I know as a candidate, I talked to somebody who asked, we got new districts because of the census. I was campaigning in a new area and talked to some guy who was clearly low income. He accused me of thinking he was wealthy and so on, and you people want to tax me more because you know how wealthy I am, and you think how wealthy I am. This guy was living in a shack. And he had been convinced by talk radio that all his money was being taken away from us, from him, for government, and it's bizarre how things have shifted that way.
I just wondered, from the historical standpoint, if you think 9/11 had an effect more of this problem, or it sent people back to the common good. Do you observe anything in result of that?
I'll tell you my impression here, what others have said. I came home, we had voted, it was primary day, so you may remember. I voted that morning and found out I was voting after the rush, because I was going to work at home that day, and found out at the polling place that the planes had crashed into the World Trade Center. I came home, what do? You can't think, you can't work on anything else. Now, what do I do? I'll go get blood. And so I called Red Cross to set up an appointment. Oh, can't get one till 1 o'clock. And well, what time do they open? 12. And I said, well, I'll just show up. And well, we prefer you to have an appointment. Okay, I'll say take an appointment at 1. So I drove in there. And by that time, everybody else had been thinking the same thing. Let's donate blood. And our local Red Cross center that has usually one or two people in there when you're giving blood, had lines down the hallway, down the stairs. It was 200 people there, and I was glad I had an appointment because I got in. But people very much, I think people said road rage, other incidents of proof of how we care about others, really improved for a few months, but very quickly, I think it fell off, and we're back to our old habits. So I don't know, did anybody else see a permanent shift from it, or did you see temporary shift at least?
I saw temporary, but then I think they're right back to the me. And I think the media has a lot to do with it. You deserve this.
Yeah. And even more so because whoever pointed out the fear.
Yeah. No. I think it's been a big distraction, yeah. And it's allowed focus to be drawn to this fear issue and away from these.
The hoard more now because somebody else, you may, times are less stable in a sense. You might have it taken away.
Well, it may have aggravated the disease.
It may have. So a quick improvement and then getting worse.
We live in a small community, been there 55 years, so I have a feeling sort of what the community feels. And I have noticed a big change. When you have any type of a drive now, the attitude is, well, what's in it for me?
Before, I gave it the office.
Yeah,
or
before it was very community-minded. And now it's much more selfish.
Is it also related to the fact that whenever that fundraising appeals, I don't know which drives which, but fundraising appeals, hey, if you give this much to this radio station, whatever, you'll get all these gifts, or you'll have a chance to win a trip to so-and-so. Are the nonprofits doing that because they sense that's what they have to do for the public, or is that helping drive the public?
I think they're getting a lot of criticism for sending address labels and bottles and all this and that, but they're
wasting money when I want my money to be used for the thing, not for more marketing.
Yeah. That's what my friends feel.
I'd like to summarize. I would say that our big problem is One word, greed. I've been in public service for 50 years, mm-hmm. and I've seen this happen. Straight down, right. With all of the individuals that you work with and you see, it's all, everything that's been said here, come right back to one thing. We're greedy. We're greedy as a nation. We're greedy as individuals. And as she said, that's good for me, mm-hmm. that's fine, but it doesn't. And well, we've been doing these things for quite some time. And I was in your place about 30 years ago, so I know what you're talking about. And it's real scary. And
I think your point about the greed is one that...
And it's materialism. It's materialism. Yeah. We have been grabbed by our society.
Would you say that's changed in those 50 years?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Is that much worse? Like,
go down to the end of the lake here, Chelan, right now, today, right this minute. And I want you to look at all the affluent out there in the water. All night long, if you stay there for one night, it's like going to a wild fraternity party. only there's thousands of people involved.
Yeah, with a lot of money. And
a lot of money. And it's just plain greed by all the generations. My generation is as bad as yours. We've just caught on. We learned from you.
To wrap this up, how do we sense it? Because I don't disagree with you. Again, that's the self-centered, the greed that's in contrast to the public. But how do we counter that? Other than, I mean, I would argue that a nonprofit saying, here, do this, and it's in your best interest to do that, sort of feeds that there's no alternative, that it has to be me first, and therefore it's in your interest to give to us. It's in your interest to do that. And I mean, that's one of the areas where the church can speak out and say, no, we're God's creatures who are supposed to be doing service to others.
I wanted to give one counterexample of where common good is still valued. And I think it draws to what you're saying, because I live in a small orchard community, not unlike Wenatchee. So we still got small family farms going on. Family in our congregation, grandpa started a business, four kids, all of them involved in my generation, all of them involved in the business, and then you got grandkids coming up for this orchard business. Treetop came and offered to buy these folks out for an ungodly amount of money. You know, I mean, just kind of like everybody in the family is more than set for the rest of their lives. So they do what good German Lutheran families do, agricultural families do, is they sit down and talk about it as a family. So number one, vote for family values of shaping.
Amen.
And the grandkids go, there's a question here? Give me the papers, we're gonna sign. I mean, we are set for the rest of our life. And my generation, not me, my generation and grandpa said, wait a minute, we've got 35, 50 or whatever labor families who are dependent upon us for their livelihood. And the family said no to Treetop. And the grandchild generation wouldn't talk to their parents for a week. It's kind of like, you know, and then they came back and said, you know, we're sorry, you're right. But it was clearly a common good decision. Yeah. It was made, in my opinion, number one, because it was a Christian family. Number two, because it's an agricultural family. A small, because I think that's where a lot of these values come from.
And they've had the same, it's the farm's been in the family for a long time. Yeah.
And because you talked about his family, you know, right? That cluster of things allowed them to move strongly, boldly as a family towards the common good without any question. But when you start breaking those things apart, I grew up in the city, you know, so families shattered. And mm-hmm. what I learned about being a city boy, growing up in agriculture, there's a whole lot you learn about values and common
right.
good that's not there anymore when you get into agriculture.
Smaller communities have an ability to do that more. Our kids went to the smallest school district in the Twin Cities area, and everybody knows everybody. You tend to look out for people you know more, and you have that sense of community. I want to make a closing comment, but two of you had a quick thing to make.
I think another counter measure that's happening is because of the internet. What happened with the organizations like MUAN.org with the protests, the war in Iraq, or the invasion of Iraq, I'd like to call it, was phenomenal. I mean, I was very involved in the Vietnam War demonstrations, and what happened in the Iraq demonstration was far more fundamental and far more community-based than the Vietnam War protest ever was. I mean, intergenerational, interracial than the Vietnam War protest ever came close to being.
People are using the internet for positive things.
And I think that there's something afoot there that I believe will
carry us forward in ways that we don't even know about yet.
These last two comments, David, did you have one more?
I had a question, just, you know, this versus now versus 100 years back, you know, what percentage of our income do we need for our necessities versus 100 years ago? You know, with that, I think there's a greater extra income there that we still haven't learned how to deal with.
Yeah, but our definition of necessity.
Yeah, our definition is changing.
Now it's essential necessity.
Well, I don't think it's a percentage thing at all. It's just how much you do want. And, you know, our parents had one car. My parents had one car, no TV, no entertainment center, and short vacation every year. And all the children were bunched up in bedrooms. And today it's far different. And we don't have to have both parents working. We want to have both parents working so we can sustain this lifestyle.
Well, I'd like to close by focusing on, there were two very positive comments at the very end, and we wouldn't be here if we weren't interested in common good. I think the whole nature of why we come to Holden Village. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I thought it was a hopeless case, if I didn't think politics had a chance to change. And sometimes, I mean, I'm angry and frustrated at times when I see 62-1 votes in our Senate for tax cuts when we have homeless people. But, you know, I figure, hey, this year I have more allies. Sometimes you're not alone. We all feel we're alone at times, but churches and others, boy, the story you told was a marvelous story. And that happens hundreds of times over. That factory owner in Massachusetts who's factory burned down, textile guy about 3-4 years ago. He was 70 years old. Instead of saying, do it, he waved off all these 600-some employees. He decided he was going to pay the employees. He was very well off. He was going to pay them until he got the factory rebuilt and reopened it. Could build cheaper overseas, cheaper labor costs. But he paid his employees while they were not working because the factory burned down, and he committed to rebuild. I mean, those are beautiful stories. You wish they didn't have to be news items, national news items, because it's seldom happening. But there are positive things. I think it suggests we've got a lot of work to do in promoting the common good. Because I do think even the examples of the greed among us and this frightening things in the rally where the guy is saying, no, for my sake, I don't want to pay more and whatever. I think there are, the vast majority, I think, still has a sense, maybe we forget about it, but we have a sense of the value of a common good, and we do care about it. And that's why the Exxons and Walmarts of the world, at the same time, they may practice individualistic greed-related things for themselves and their stockholders, but at the same time, they still want to sell it to the public that we're a community-based, we're a common good people. And so I think there is a lot of hope there, and I thought it was nice to have a couple of comments at the end saying some, because this is not supposed to be a depressing thing. It's where we stand and how do we move forward from here. So I thank you for coming, and I'm happy to stay around and talk some more. So thank you.